In the pretty city of Spokane, a serial killer is on the loose.
This is where Kathy Brisbois's body was eventually recovered.
The man they hunted was one with dual obsessions, using prostitutes and weapons.
Police not only know that they have somebody with an arsenal of weapons, but they actually have clinical evidence from a doctor saying this person is potentially dangerous.
Douglas Perry was the gun-obsessed murderer targeting sex workers, but tracking him was not going to be easy.
By 1994, he was identifying as a woman in a man's body, and he was a self-described transsexual.
It's in Thailand that Douglas Perry becomes Donna Perry.
As detectives in Spokane attend the latest discovery of a body, the question arises, what could possibly be going on inside the mind of a serial killer? If it could talk, the Spokane River would have a lot of stories to tell, not all of them good. It once teemed with salmon heading upstream. A dam built in the 19th century put paid to that. The rainbow trout caught today are not fit for human consumption because of the pollution caused by industrial practices. And by its banks, a brutal series of murders carried out by a man with a deeply disturbed mind.
He's basically just done with this. This may be the only time he was fought with, and he is done with this, and that is gone. And he spent too much time and made too much noise, and he's got to get out of here. So he's not going to go down there and try and cover the body. So when you stand here looking down, you can see it pretty easily. Just like the others, there was no attempt to hide the bodies in either the other two. They were just disposed of.
The victims were Yolanda Sapp, Nikki Lowe, and Kathy Brisbois.
The three murders occurred over a period of about 3 months at the beginning of 1990. The women were all sex workers in the area of East Sprague Avenue.
The man who killed them was Douglas Perry. It took 22 years to catch him. By the time he was in custody, he was no longer Douglas. He was Donna.
Donna Perry claims that one of the reasons why she had that sex change operation was that she felt that if she had her genitals taken away as a man and got rid of that portion of her life, then she wouldn't be as violent. She wouldn't have that desire anymore to kill.
Perry said, well, Doug didn't stop it, Donna stopped it.
What made Douglas Perry a serial killer? And why did Donna make him stop? Getting inside the mind of Douglas Perry begins in the countryside of the state of Washington.
Doug Perry was living as a child in an orchard in Omak, Washington, which is kind of this north central part of the state of Washington. It's rural, predominantly farming, ranching communities. So he was raised on that orchard, father, mother, older brother.
So far, so normal, but far from the complete picture.
He was molested by his dad. Picked on in the family and abused emotionally, sexually, and physically.
The adolescent was one crazy, mixed-up kid. His best friends became guns. He had a wide selection.
He really seemed to have an affinity to guns. He loved them a lot.
When he describes a firearm, it's almost as if it's taken on a human characteristics and he's in love with the actual weapon itself.
His father died in 1968 from a burst blood vessel. His mother, who then became the primary caregiver, was admitted into a psychiatric facility with schizophrenia. Guns became Douglas's lifelong obsession. By 1974, aged 21, Douglas Perry had quite the collection as he pursued his hobby. He hoarded them, tended to their every need, and fired them into the Washington countryside, long into the night.
That many of all these various pistols and rifles and shotguns and all of this ammunition, I mean, like, this guy is preparing for battle.
The once abused child had grown into a man willing and able to defend himself. His rap sheet in the 70s included assault and charges related to using his array of weapons. Linda Papadopoulos has been delving into the facts of Perry's life, unlocking the secrets of his mind.
In 1990, Perry's living in Spokane, Washington.
The previous year, he'd been picked up by police for patronizing a prostitute in his new hometown. It was behavior associated with a second obsession, sex workers.
One of the things that we do know is that he often used sex workers. And in fact, we are not aware of any significant relationships outside of this sort of transactional relationship that he had with sex workers.
What does that say about the complicated mind of Douglas Perry?
You know, this attests to perhaps the idea that he felt uncomfortable around social relationships. He felt unable to connect with people, or perhaps more insidiously, what he valued within the relationships that he had with sex workers was his ability to dictate the terms, to control, to use. So there was something about kind of commodifying and objectifying women.
Summing up the makeup of the mind of Douglas Perry in 1989, it's clear he's a dangerous man. He tended to violence, and his lifestyle was dominated by a love of guns and a use of sex workers. And there was a third element, his feelings generally towards women.
He didn't like women. He found them disgusting and vile. At least the women that were involved in the sex trade, that were prostitutes. He viewed them as pond scum.
That's how he described sex workers to a cellmate when serving time later on for weapons offences. A conversation featuring an outlandish, still unproven claim.
He allegedly told his cellmate that he had murdered up to 9 prostitutes and that he killed them because they were pond scum who were wasting their lives and that because they could have children and he couldn't.
What he said is he hated the prostitutes. And he hated them because they could reproduce. And they were wasting it.
He may have hated them, but by 1990 he was spending a lot of time with prostitutes in a city, Spokane, which stars itself as offering urban chic. Outwardly affluent, the sex workers are not easy to find unless you know where to look. There are some areas where chic has been swapped for cheap sex. Yolanda Anastasia Sapp, just 26 years old, would ready herself most evenings to ply her trade in the Sprague area of the city. Her favourite spot, just a mile from the river.
It is important to remember that regardless of the choices that people had made, could be because of addictions or any number of reasons, that these were the daughters of somebody that loved them, the friends, the sisters of somebody who cared, regardless of their life choices that they made.
Douglas Perry knew the area and, aged 37, had decided to act on his dual obsession. Hating prostitutes, loving guns. As he cruised Spokane's red light district, Yolanda Sapp was preparing for a night's work, about to pick up her next paying customer.
And Yolanda basically found herself in this awful situation with a person that described sex workers as the scum of the earth. This is somebody that not only saw women as less than, but in particular, he saw sex workers as disposable, as in, you know, not even human.
Not far from the river, an area of wasteland near East Trent Road, Spokane. Perry had already checked out the lie of the land.
He came up here and had to have parked in this area. This hasn't changed that much up here. It's always been a little bit of a kind of a turnout, turnaround. It's secluded mostly from Trent, so people could come back here and kids could drink beer and that kind of stuff.
The noise from the Great Spokane River drowns out a lot, like screams perhaps. It is February 21st, 1990, when Douglas Perry is in his car with a gun and an urge to kill. He also has a plan to avoid being caught. On the streets of Spokane, Yolanda Sapp cut a striking figure and was, according to her boyfriend, popular to those looking to pay for sex.
This is a woman like any other. This is a young woman with hopes and dreams and desire to be loved and cared about like any other. And I think it's important to remember that.
Douglas Perry came across her. It's likely she walked up to his car, asked if he was looking to party.
We have a person who has an obsessive and possibly strange relationship with the guns that he owns, with the prostitutes in the area, with the women in his life, who had an opportunity to lash out.
Perry, no stranger to the ritual of hiring a sex worker, beckoned her inside his vehicle. The couple drove off. They headed to Perry's home. It soon becomes clear Perry is not interested in sex. Within hours of picking Yolanda Sapp up on the streets of Spokane, Perry had shot her three times. He headed towards the river to get rid of Yolanda's body. The next day, February 22nd, Yolanda was reported missing. Later, passers-by on the trail overlooking the river called police. Yolanda's feet were bound by a distinctive green blanket. Aside from that, she was naked, her body left as if a trophy on display.
When you read the report about how this young woman's body was found, it was treated with a lot of contempt. Her breasts and genitalia are exposed.
Douglas Perry wasn't trying to hide his victims and get away with murder. He was trying to send a message. This was his calling card. He was displaying them as if they were trophies.
In a bitter irony, Perry knew his victims as friends of his own girlfriend, also a sex worker. He would even help the prostitutes by bringing them food, yet now he was looking to kill them.
He had an interesting relationship with the prostitutes who worked on that street. He also worked on that street. He told police later that he had been feeding them and taking them to his home, and people saw him doing that. He was presenting the image of someone who was trying to help prostitutes.
I think what this really speaks to is this kind of incongruous relationship that he has with what it means to be a woman. At the same time, he deifies and vilifies. So the woman is something that is the mother, is this angelic figure that can give life, that can create, and then, you know, the prostitute, the sex worker, is someone that's the opposite of that, the underbelly of that, that takes away life because she doesn't have children. And interestingly enough, I think he sees himself as kind of delving in both. On the one hand, I want to become this mother and be better, and, you know, and I'll never be able to do that. So what I can do, though, is balance the stakes by killing what I see, in these awful words he used, as the pawn scum of the earth.
He'd killed just once, but he would soon kill again. Perry was not considered a suspect in the murder of Yolanda Sapp. His rap sheet didn't suggest him as someone who should be in the frame.
But if you look at the crimes that he partook in, from simple assault to assaults, most of them were firearm related. He would be on the radar screen for firearms type of offenses.
So he was free and able to hunt for another victim.
Clearly, at this point, Yolanda's friends, other sex workers in the area, would have heard about this, and this would have induced a climate of fear. One of their own, a young woman, was killed in the most brutal of ways.
Behind the barbed wire and locked doors of seedy motel rooms off East Sprague in Spokane, Nikki Lowe, 35 years old, worked as a prostitute. Known to police as a drug user, she was officially designated a street-level prostitute. As night fell in the city, Nikki, like her co-sex workers, would put herself on display before joining the tricks in their cars. She might head to a district of warehouses or alleyways. She may head towards the main roads over the Spokane River. One, Green Street, has a busy underpass. Not far from this underpass, Douglas Perry slows down on seeing Nikki Lowe. She will have had no problem approaching him. His was a familiar face.
He would have been well known in the prostitution community because he would have been a familiar face as somebody who dates these very prostitutes that he would kill.
She climbs in, and the couple head for Perry's place. On March 25th, 1990, a mile from the underpass on East South Riverton, the body of Nikki Lowe was found. She was draped over the guardrail next to the road, abandoned, like an object to be thrown in the trash.
He murdered and posed and placed these women naked in the very locations where their bodies were found.
He dehumanizes them, and there's even arrogance. The way that he tries to rationalize what he did is by saying, well, you know, they weren't needed. There's no point in having these women in society. They give nothing. So almost trying to not only excuse himself, but say he's done a good thing.
Searching for evidence, detectives came across a trash dumpster nearby in which they found, amongst other things, a sweater, a pair of blue tennis shoes, sex lubricant, and a hypodermic syringe. The contents of the dumpster were those of Nikki Lowe. The evidence was kept, but at that stage did not incriminate Douglas Perry. He was still a free man. Fifty-one days after the discovery of the body of Nikki Lowe, Kathy Brisbow left downtown Spokane and headed towards her patch where she worked as a sex worker. It was about 200 yards from the river on a road called East Trent. Douglas Perry spotted her, pulled up alongside her. The gun obsessive was armed with one of his small caliber weapons. Sometime later that night, Kathy Brisbow, still alive, had gone with Perry to a secluded area that he knew all too well.
Doug Perry brought Kathy Brisbow here. He drove in along that embankment where that dirt mound is built up. I think basically they came here to do the sex act, whatever that was. And that either before, during, or after, she must have had some sort of event that caused her enough concern that she probably tried to get away from him. So she ended up losing a coat. She lost her shoes over there. The jacket was found up in this area. She probably outran him down to there because when we get down to the bottom of that hill, he's probably chasing her. And then we start seeing blood drops. So he may have injured her up here, but we wouldn't see the blood till she gets down there on the path.
Brisbow had told her fellow sex workers that if she was abducted, she wouldn't go without a fight.
Well, I think basically she was fighting for her life.
Kathy Brisbow could not know it, but her fight would lead to the arrest of a female prisoner called Donna, thousands of miles away from the Spokane River, and 22 years later. Hers was a story long in the telling. Kathy Brisbow's fight with Douglas Perry continued as she and he tussled down the embankment near the Spokane River. As she tried to stay alive, she grabbed at his arms.
She obviously battled well enough to collect DNA under her fingernails of skin from him. It wouldn't have been from scratching his coat or grabbing his hair. It's more likely that she scratched some skin off and probably left scratches on him doing it to collect enough skin so that would be still there 20 years later.
The encounter saw the couple scramble down to what is now called the Centennial Trail. Detectives could follow the path of the scrap.
Back then, in kind of starting in this area, we started to see some blood drops and some pieces of hair and clumps of hair on the ground. And right down here on that bush here was a sundress. So if you keep going just a little bit past that, is a spot where you look over the edge and her body was visible from up here, down over the edge.
At some point, one of the guns that Douglas Perry considered part of his family put an end to the fight. Kathy was shot through the head and the chest and left to die at the foot of this trail.
In this general area, and there wasn't quite as much foliage as there is now, but in this general area, her body was about halfway down that embankment.
Spokane had suffered the loss of three women in just 4 months.
Three prostitutes, all killed in the same general area, posed in the same way. There are too many coincidences, all killed by firearms. I would definitely be thinking, there's a link, there's a connection. We have a serial killer amongst our midst.
They started a task force to work on a serial killer in 1990. DNA was in a position where you needed a pretty significant amount of blood drop to get any DNA results.
The DNA exposed at the scene of the crime was that of Kathy, not her killer. So the original investigators needed more evidence.
So they were focusing on other trace evidence, and fibers were a big deal. There were green fibers that were all throughout this case that seemed to be somewhat of a commonality in the cases.
Green fibers on the clothes of Kathy Brisbane were eventually recovered from the deserted area. Green fibers were found on the second victim, Nikki Lowe, and on a green blanket binding the legs of Yolanda Sapp. But that evidence led detectives nowhere. In fact, this was a case where too many avenues of inquiry existed, none of which led to the killer.
There were many, 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 many suspects. They were prostitutes, they had drug habits, therefore they had drug dealers, they had pimps, they had, people that are known to, in general, not be nice to you if you didn't behave correctly.
But the persona of Douglas Perry wouldn't be on anyone's radar in regards to the killing of these ladies. He would be on the radar for firearms violations, not these kind of murders.
The fingernails of Kathy Brisbane were kept on file. Who knew when they might be useful? Under those nails, fragments of skin so small that they offered no DNA reading. But one day they would. As months passed, no credible leads were found. The case went cold. Douglas Perry remained free. By the mid-1990s, Perry was beginning to come to terms with who he actually was. Douglas seems to have decided to become Donna.
By 1994, he was identifying as a woman in a man's body, and he was a self-described transsexual. So it's possible that he was having relationships with women and men. He said he was a male prostitute as well. So he was probably using both personas at the time, both Doug and Donna.
In 1998, Perry is again arrested. Prison had by no means quenched his desire to cruise the streets of Spokane in search of sex.
Perry was stopped by the police down there after a date that he had. He took this girl back to his house.
He brings a sex worker home, and she's really upset by what she sees. She sees an arsenal of weapons.
She was really creeped out about the weapons, all the weapons around.
We're talking, not kitchen knives here. We're talking crossbows. We're talking, assortment of guns and paraphernalia.
He was saying he wasn't going to hurt her because he liked her. So when he took her back downtown to the street corner, she flagged down the first cop, she said, and said, I want to tell you about this weird date that I just had. Oh, and there he goes. And so the police went and stopped him and identified him.
So she goes to the police and she raises the alarm.
Police find 5 pipe bombs, 49 guns, 20,000 rounds of ammunition, all in his house. There was yet more evidence in the paperwork recovered by police.
They find an assessment by a psychologist that attests to his pathological feelings and beliefs around women. It attests to these feelings of sort of intense misogyny for women. It attests to his violence.
There is writings about his mental health, and it's from mental health workers about his disdain and disgust for women.
So the police now not only know that they have somebody with an arsenal of weapons, which suggests that, you know, he has a predisposition or at least a like or an interest in violence or violent weapons, but they actually also have clinical evidence from a doctor saying this person is potentially dangerous.
So the Spokane police have indications now that this is a man with some psychotic problems that hates women.
The psychological assessment that the police find on Perry gives the police the first insights into his gender dysphoria. So actually, we can deduce that possibly this assessment was there because he was thinking about having a sex change. Clearly, within the report, the doctor outlines the steps that he would need to take in terms of living as a female, in terms of what he'd need to do and the parameters around that. So this suggests that while he's dealing with these very sort of intense feelings of violence and misogyny around, you know, the females that he encounters, at the same time, he's also dealing with this identity crisis about, you know, what his gender is, who he wants to be, and how he's going to change who he is at the moment.
Perry is jailed on offences related to his arms stash, but he is still not considered a murder suspect, let alone a serial killer. During his sentence, he's transferred to an institution dealing with prisoners who have mental health issues.
This is largely based on his own self-report, was that he had been diagnosed with paranoid personality disorder.
It is now when in the mental home that Perry unburdens his conscience to a fellow prisoner. He reveals what he really thinks about the kind of woman that he has killed.
He shares intimate details with a fellow cellmate about his vile disgust and hatred for women. He talks about prostitutes and refers to them as that pond scum. But more importantly, he says he hates them, finds them so disgusting because he himself cannot produce, cannot procreate, cannot carry a child. And he looks at those prostitutes as a waste of time because they're wasting their bodies. Now he shares those details with that inmate, and that would later be very helpful in the prosecution.
The witness would be helpful, but not for another 14 years. After being released, Douglas Perry decides it's time for drastic action. He no longer wants to be a man.
In the year 2000, he's finally released from prison where he was serving 2 years for weapons offenses. And he decides finally to address the gender dysphoria he's been feeling and goes to Thailand for sex reassignment surgery.
Douglas Perry has gathered enough money that he takes a trip and he goes to Thailand. It's in Thailand that Douglas Perry becomes Donna Perry.
A chance to finally address the real issues that he'd wrestled with perhaps all of his life. Or did Douglas Perry suspect that one day he might be brought to justice as a serial killer? So why not become Donna?
Some people have pointed out to the fact that, you know what, maybe he did this as a way of throwing the police off the scent. Yes, he spoke to the cellmate about the murders, but he didn't confess to the police about them at this point. So is he leaving the country, you know, changing his appearance, changing his gender, because this is something that he really wants to do? Or is this kind of ticking a lot of boxes in terms of the fear that he feels about being held accountable for his crimes?
If he was, it had worked. Douglas Perry was left behind in Thailand in the year 2000, and Donna Perry returned to the States. That fact was not going to help Murder Squad detectives.
Meanwhile, back in the States, in Spokane, Washington, you have these detectives, a 10-year-old murder case, three women. They're convinced they're looking for a man. Perhaps they'll find Douglas Perry, but they're looking for a man. There's no way that they could have ever possibly conceived that the same man who hated women so much would become the very women that he hated. So as a homicide detective, very difficult. It would then again be as if Douglas Perry was wiped off the face of the earth. And therefore, where do you go?
The investigation went nowhere for another 9 years. Advances in DNA technology meant that Spokane detectives like Jim Dresbach felt it worthwhile sending the fingernails of Kathy Brisbow, still on file, to a lab in Marysville, Washington State.
Well, in 2009, not 6 months after the case was sent to the Marysville lab, I got a call from one of the scientists that said, asked me to sit down, which I always love when you get a call that says, are you sitting down? Because it never seems to mean bad news. So I said, oh yeah. She said that she developed a full male profile from under the left middle finger of Kathy Brisbow. And therefore, that then is a huge lead that we've kind of been waiting for, and everything else has been exhausted.
Almost certainly, Dresbach now had the DNA profile of whoever had killed Kathy. He was hoping that the killer's DNA would be on the national database called CODIS, and if it was, would it reveal Douglas Perry? But he was now a she. How does that work in cases like this? In 2009, a shard of skin found under the fingernails of victim Kathy Brisbow as she'd scratched her attacker revealed a DNA profile nearly two decades after her murder. But there was no match to the DNA on the national database.
That gives us work to do, because we have a full male profile that is suspect now. So we can go around to all of these people, and the city detectives took a dozen reference samples from possible suspects that had been suspects for a long time, couldn't really be eliminated, but wasn't enough to include them as suspects either. So they just kind of sat there. So they went around and took 12 samples, sent them out to the lab to be compared to this unknown male DNA.
Did they have a breakthrough? No.
They were all eliminated.
To get a DNA match, the former Douglas, now Donna Perry, had to commit a felony which would require her to yield DNA. Thus far, Perry had never given up his DNA. The case was about to be blown open. One Perry obsession had not completely deserted when he became she.
Donna Perry may have changed her outer being, still didn't change who she was on the inside, that fascination with firearms.
In 2012, 62-year-old woman Donna Perry is arrested by police for having firearms, which are illegal, and she's taken in.
And yet again, another federal firearms charge. But now it's 2012. DNA has really come to the forefront. And there's a federal requirement that once you're incarcerated, you have to provide a sample of your DNA.
So they take a sample from that person, which is a buccal swab, which amounts to swabbing, you know, between the cheek and gum with essentially a Q-tip, putting it in a box and shipping it off and waiting for them to come back and say, yep, it's a match, or no, it's not.
The serial killer Douglas, now Donna, was about to be confronted with her crimes.
You see, Donna Perry thought she could change her outer look, but the way she is molecularly designed on the inside, that will never change, despite what may be going on. Her DNA does not change. As a result of providing a sample of her DNA, The detectives in Spokane are notified.
Marysville called me again and said, we got a hit in CODIS on a name of who this DNA matches. They said it was Donna, AKA Douglas Perry.
And as a detective, I would have looked at the results and saw Donna Perry and been, oh my gosh, we have a woman. We were looking for a man all these years. I would have been blown away by the name Donna Perry.
Dresbach and his colleagues felt that they had a strong case. A fingerprint found on a bottle in the dumpster after the murder of Nikki Lowe matched Donna Perry's.
There was the DNA evidence, there was the fingerprint evidence, there was the circumstantial evidence of seeing her with the prostitutes, there was the testimony of her cellmate from 1998 who said that she admitted to the crimes.
The officers read her the charges.
She was in the room by herself, and so then I just waited for a little bit. Then I went back in with this, and I read it to her, and when I read that the charge was murder, she said, murder? Murder? Who am I supposed to have murdered? Murder?
After all, Donna Perry hadn't murdered anybody.
Now, there were a couple other points during this interview that she said things that made it seem as if she was making a clear break between her personality as Donna and her past as Douglas. She said that she had gotten gender reassignment surgery to control her violent tendencies. She said that when, again, pressed, did you kill these women, did you kill these women, did you kill these women, she said no, but it was 20 years ago, and if Douglas did, I don't know.
This approach from Donna was a sign of a defense strategy to come. Investigators, even when they have significant scientific evidence, still like to get a confession.
What I wanted to do is I wanted to get her to acknowledge that she committed this crime.
An admission would not be forthcoming.
She's consistently reiterating that she didn't kill anyone, that Donna didn't kill anyone.
A colleague of Dresbach's gave Donna Perry enough rope to get what detectives felt that they needed, as he told her this.
We know that when people kill more than one person, it tends to continue on, and it goes on and on and on. What made this stop? Why did these stop? And that was really, that's a twofold question. One is to see if we'll get an indication that there were other victims that maybe we don't know about. Or two, to see if we can get an admission of some sort. Because she's still denying. No, I've never seen these people. And in this case, Perry said, well, Doug didn't stop it, Donna stopped it. That's as close to saying I did it as anything I've ever seen in an interview room.
22 years after the murder of three women whose bodies were abandoned by the riverside, Spokane police had their man. But would the woman he now was be found guilty?
I think what's really pathological about what Donna Perry does is she tries to scapegoat herself years earlier, tries to scapegoat the man she was for these murders. And she's very clear. She says, I did nothing as Donna Perry. I did nothing as this woman I am. It was all about this horrible man that I was.
Can somebody who identified themselves at one point in their life as a man now identify themselves as a woman and say, I'm changed, I haven't done those activities, and that's not me. Douglas Perry is dead. I am Donna Perry.
The jury unanimously rejected the Donna Perry defense. She was found guilty. Psychologist Linda Papadopoulos confirms the prevailing scientific view.
The extent to which this happens as a ploy, that she's just trying to rationalize this, trying to play the system, or if it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. Maybe she believed so deeply that, you know, this testosterone was, you know, what was making her violent. It's a really sick way of conceptualizing it. There is absolutely no connection with gender dysphoria and psychopathic tendencies. There's absolutely none.
Donna Perry did not kill because she was transgender. Rather, Douglas Perry killed because he was a sadistic killer.
When you come down to the law, did Donna Perry, at the time that she was Douglas Perry, did she know the taking of life was wrong, was against the law? And clearly, it would be yes. Resoundingly, it would be yes.
no matter what gender Perry was, he was still guilty of being a serial killer.
I would think that the danger of Perry is that Perry doesn't look like what Perry is capable of. Perry looks like a meek, mild, doddering old woman, but it has potential that's far beyond what they look like.
And for seasoned detectives, the judge, jury, and law's attitude to those who claim innocence for the actions of her former self when a different gender came as a relief.
It sets a real precedent that she was ultimately incarcerated for these murders, because if that was the precedent, can you imagine the number of murderers who would suddenly, if they knew somebody was hot on their trail, would opt for a sex change operation somewhere?
Because I think she's kind of confusing what it means to have gender dysphoria. She didn't have, you know, multiple personalities. This is somebody whose personality traits were there, were consistent. You know, what she did wasn't about how she felt about her gender. She did this because of how she felt about women, the anger, the violence that she had within her. And I think whether she was male or female is almost besides the point.
The mind of the serial killer Douglas Perry may well work differently now that she is Donna Perry. But Jim Dresbach doesn't care. Perry was a killer and could not hide behind a sex change operation.
You kill somebody, you're going to get caught. And I don't care if you go to the extent of changing your sex by surgery or not, or color your face or cut your hair, you're going to get caught.
It doesn't matter what the genitalia says. What matters in this case is what the DNA says. Donna Perry, Douglas Perry, they're one and the same. They are the killers.
Donna Perry, gun obsessive, transgender, and serial killer, was sentenced to life without parole.